No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So please join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. We have a special guest this week, a delegate from the House of Delegates in Virginia, Mark Keene. But first, Maria and I are going to talk a little bit about Maria and I. So and the issues that are coming up in our lives. So welcome, Maria. It's always great to have you on the show. Of course, it wouldn't be Shadow Politics without you. So
thank you.
Yeah, welcome to the show. And let me first start by just saying it's been a big week for DC statehood, not in a good way. We were supposed to have a hearing on the 24th of this of the month, this Wednesday.
Yeah, I had it on my calendar.
Yeah, it would have been the first such hearing in almost 25 years, but we've canceled it. We postponed it because Robert Mueller is going to be testifying on that day, and obviously that's going to soak up the entire news cycle. In addition to that, though, Gallup just released a poll that shows that 68% of the American people polled do not want D.C. to become a state.
Oh, kidding.
No, you know, part of our problem, and I've written an article, we hope it'll appear soon, is that we don't put any money into this. We think that people understand what statehood is. And they really don't understand what it is for the District of Columbia. First of all, you have to be well into your 60s to remember the last time a state was entered into the Union. It was 60 years ago that Alaska was admitted to the Union. So that's one thing. People don't really understand how statehood works. And another thing is, most Americans, almost 80% of them, believe that we have the same rights as everybody else. So they really don't understand why we even want statehood. And another terrible thing that's happened to us is we have yet another city councilman under federal investigation.
Oh, dear.
And now Republicans in the same committee where we're going to hold our hearing want to have a hearing on his corruption and malfeasance. So it's it's hard for me to see how you're going to have a corruption hearing and then a few weeks later come back and say, oh, by the way, we want to be a state. The two don't necessarily go hand in hand, but we all understand the reality that this doesn't make the District of Columbia look very good. So those are the kind of obstacles we're up against. How are things in California?
Well, California is going through a heat wave, as is much of the country. In fact, I had my surgery on Tuesday, July 9th, and on Monday of this week, my surgeon took out the stitches from the graft site and from the surgical site, and she cleared me to fly on Wednesday, because I was supposed to fly Monday of this week to Chicago for summer session for school, which is separate and in addition to summer semester. And so I did leave Wednesday morning, and I had Board of Trustees events to attend because I was elected as the student representative with full voting rights, which is not always usual. And then I attended a student governance meeting with the other student body presidents because our university has different colleges. And then I attended summer session. And then I attended a development luncheon or breakfast where I spoke about I received a scholarship at the beginning of this year and what it meant to me and how I was able to utilize it for the furtherance of my dissertation. So Friday I was supposed to fly home because I was only going to be there for a brief 36 hours. And there was a horrific storm in Chicago on Thursday, thunder and lightning, that stopped all planes from arriving, canceled. Had electrical problems. So Friday morning, everybody who couldn't get out Thursday was wrapped into Friday. So I got bumped from a 10 a.m. flight, 11:40 a.m. flight, a 1 p.m. flight. And I decided I'm just going to go back to the hotel and spend the night and then fly out Saturday morning. Saturday morning at 6:30, I got bumped. So I scrambled and found a flight from Chicago to Portland, Oregon, and then again from Portland, Oregon to LAX. So then my bag got lost, and by the time it was all said and done, I had been up 21 hours trying to get out of town just yesterday alone. So it was, it's the first time I've ever had anything like that. And Michael, you travel a fair amount. Have you encountered those sorts of challenges?
It's funny that you say that. No, we really haven't, but my daughter, who traveled to Chicago and back recently, just had exactly the same thing happen to her. We took her to the airport. They bumped three of her flights. We had to go back to Baltimore, pick her up, bring her home, take her the next morning. We took her the next morning. They bumped a couple of her flights. She didn't get out till middle afternoon. So it was the same thing. And it's funny, it was Chicago. It was just a mess. And again, it was weather related. So I really haven't had much of that problem, but she did. So.
Well, I keep thinking, I'm too old for this, you know. I mean, it's like there was a flight attendant that was next to me on Friday that she had been in the airport for 30 hours trying to get out. She spent the night on the floor the night before because she was stuck too, and she had to get back to California to get to work because she had been on holiday. And when I left, she started crying. Because she had been busy unburdening herself to me with everything that was going bad and wrong and stuff like that. And I rubbed her shin and I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm going to go back to the hotel. I'm not going to stay here the rest of the day. Because the rest of the flights that day on Friday in Chicago were not only overbooked, they were oversold. Yeah. So everybody, of course, who was supposed to get out on Thursday would take priority for Friday. I understand that. That's business. But the fact that it kept spilling over then into Saturday yesterday was further complicating. And I was like, I just want to get home. Could I please get home?
Yeah, no, it's not what it used to be, is it?
No, but I'm home. And I got a good night's sleep and I did my laundry and unpacked and got my puppy and went to the market. And I'm ready, was ready for your broadcast. I just did a homework assignment right before we got on the air. And I was like, okay, back to normal.
Okay, well, here we go. Do we have Delegate Kim with us? Kim with us? Mark Kim, are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Senator. This is Mark Kim.
Hi. Hello. Mark, thank you so much for coming. Look,
sure.
Delegate Kim and I met at a dinner one night. My wife described him as like the most charming guy she'd met in a very long time, and I agree 100%. I agree
100%. Wow, that's a huge compliment from your wife.
Really is. He really is charming and engaging. So thank you so much for being on our show, Dolly Kim.
It's an absolute honor, and I thank you for your time.
And you know what?
Not everybody. I was going to ask Michael, if you don't mind, before we get into the meat and potatoes. Do you mind sharing with us your journey, and decisions, and preparation, and successes and failures that got you to where you are today? On Sunday, July 21st?
Oh, well, Maria, thank you. I'm going to keep it pretty short because I don't think my life is all that interesting. But the simple version is I was born in Korea, and my family has traveled quite a bit when I was a child. My father was a missionary, so we ended up living in a couple of different countries along the way, Vietnam and Australia, before we ended up coming to the United States. So I came here as a teenager and ended up going to high school and college in California, where we first settled down. I was studying political science, and I was always interested in the history and biography of people that made a difference in this world. And so when I had a chance to intern in Washington, D.C. as a college student, I took that chance, and I came out to – actually, I lived in Virginia, Falls Church, Virginia, and I was commuting into D.C. for an internship. And I just fell in love with the city. I fell in love with politics, the idea that these marble halls was where so much has happened, and seeing all the great men and women who were working there, I thought – maybe one day there might be a place for somebody like me in this role. So I went back to California, ended up going to grad school, went to law school. And while I was studying in the grad school, I had a chance to apply for some jobs in Washington, D.C. So I thought, I'll come out here again maybe for a couple of years. And that was over 25 years ago. So now I've been in the D.C. area, having worked in federal government, having worked in the private sector. Also had a chance to work on many, many different political campaigns, including running for President Obama's first presidential campaign in Fairfax County, Obama, as the chairman of that campaign. That led me to running for office myself. And so in 2009, I did something fairly audacious, as President Obama might say. I ran for office and became a member of the House of Delegates, which, by the way, in about 2 weeks, we're going to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the first convening of the House of Delegates in Virginia. Back then in 1619, we called ourselves the House of Burgesses, but that was the first time that a legislative body that was democratically elected was ever convened in North America. And so we are going to celebrate the 400th anniversary next month, or next, I guess, 2 weeks from now.
So did you win your first go with elections?
Yes, ma'am. I ran in a four-way Democratic primary, and I was lucky enough to win that election. And then in the general election, I had a squeaker of an election, but I was able to win. That was 10 years ago. I'm running for my re-election now, but for some reason, I don't have an opponent, so I assume I'm going to win this year.
Well, you don't have an opponent probably because you're doing a good job. You know, nobody wants to run against somebody that's successful and popular. So I would, you know, at least that would be my official position, is that I don't have an opponent because I'm too good. But, you know,
I'm trying to follow in the footsteps of your professional career as well, Sandra. So,
Well, you know, it's funny that you should bring up the fact that you're about to have your 400th anniversary as a legislative body, because one of the facts that I found interesting about you is that you're the first Korean American ever elected to statewide office in Virginia. We just had Michael Steele on the show a little while ago, the former Lieutenant Governor of Maryland. He was the first African American elected statewide in Maryland. I mean, I find this stuff so hard to believe in a state that's diverse and 400 years old that you should be the first Korean-American elected.
Yeah, 10 years ago when I was elected, it turned out that I was the first person actually born in Asia anywhere who was born and then came to America as an immigrant to get elected at the state level. But I always say, you know, it's nice to be the first, but I don't want to be the last. And so my mission is to make sure that we have as many people that reflect the diversity of our state and our country in all levels of government as well as in the private sector. I mean, you know, we need leadership everywhere, including in corporate boardrooms, behind news desks, and on TV, and athletics and entertainment. Everywhere where there's a place where people can make an influence in other people's lives, we need to make sure that people that look like the rest of America are holding those jobs.
So, Delegate Team, when you were doing your work behind the scenes versus what you're doing now as an elected official, do you see a difference in the experience? Is there a disparity at all?
Well, I think the biggest difference being an office holder versus somebody who, and I've had a chance to, you know, be a senior staff to a U.S. senator as well as working in politics and government in different capacities. But I think the biggest difference is that if it's your name that's on the ballot and if it's your name that's on the board when you vote yes or no on the measure, you have 100% accountability, and you can't blame anybody else for anything that you do or you don't do. And so that sense of immediate accountability is what's important, and that makes me think really carefully about every position I take. Every time I say something, I want to make sure that it is who I am, that I'm not just saying something for the convenience or doing something out of political expediency, but that it's something I can hold myself to. I don't want to ever be in a position where I say something to one person and then, you know, I say something to another person and then I find out that I was inconsistent. Just like if I vote one way now, I'm going to make sure I'm going to vote the same way again in the future. And that idea that I need to be accountable to the people who elect me, I think that's given me a sense of seriousness about this job. That as a staffer, I mean, you know, you can be very close to your boss and you can be really engaged in an issue, but at the end of the day, when you go home, you know, you've done your job, but you're not 100% responsible for what happened. Whereas if you're the member, you are responsible for every vote you cast.
Well said.
I know, and it is well said, and it's been a big problem for me as my children have grown and moved out of my home, because for 30 years I got to blame everything on them. You know, my wife, Mrs. Brown would say, who left the door open? And I go, ah, one of the damn kids. You know? So now, unfortunately, I'm taking responsibility for everything. I want to move on to a somewhat delicate subject. I'm sure this is an important thing to you. I know it is to Maria and I. But there was an article in the Washington Post last week about a special legislative session that was called by the legislature in Virginia on guns, yep. and it yep. adjourned after 90 minutes without one gun bill being taken up. We've just had a couple of horrible murders in Washington. We had a little girl, you know, besides the Virginia Beach massacre where 12 people were killed, we had a little girl who was 9 years old who was shot and killed while waiting to ride a pony at a fair in Richmond. And,
right.
and on Friday, we just had an 11-year-old boy here in Washington who got in a dispute at a McDonald's, and some guy, a 28-year-old, walked out to the car he was in and shot and killed him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just horrible, delegate. What's the problem with guns in Virginia? Can you tell us why they can't seem to move legislation forward?
Well, it is obviously a big, big disappointment for all of us that nothing happened on July 9th when we reconvened for a special session. At a minimum, we thought we would have at least a few days of debate, committee meetings, you know, testimony, hearings, and then some votes up and down. Now, being in the minority party, we didn't have any illusions that we're going to be able to pass major legislation. We didn't expect, you know, three or four Republicans to switch their votes after years and years of voting with NRA. So certainly we were not walking in with the idea that we might be able to pass a lot of legislation, but we thought at least give us a chance to have the debate, let the American people and Virginians who are impacted by gun violence every day, let them have a chance to see where their legislators stand on these issues and give them a voice, give them a chance to talk about why gun violence is so horribly impacting their lives. And so the 12 victims of Virginia Beach and the 11,000 people who've lost their lives in Virginia because of guns since Virginia Tech tragedy of 2007 until now, let them have a chance to hear about what the state government can do to protect them better. And yet, instead of having those hearings and having those committee meetings, that we had 90 minutes of just speech after speech after speech, and then a procedural resolution to adjourn. And now we've adjourned until middle of November, and that date wasn't chosen arbitrarily. That happens to be after our elections. As you might know, 140 yeah. of us, 100 in the Senate, in the House and 40 in the Senate, will be up for our reelection this year and on November 5th, which means that if we meet in Richmond after November 5th, it'll be after the elections are over. So clearly, I mean, people like me and many of my colleagues have no problems whatsoever standing up in front of our constituents, telling them where we stand on these bills, and then taking a vote, and then asking our voters to consider that. But apparently some of my Republican colleagues didn't feel that they had the guts to stand up in front of their constituents, tell them where they stood on these bills, and instead they punted the debate until after November. So that was a real shame, a real disappointment, and unfortunately we will not see any legislation in Virginia on gun violence issues, at least until November.
And what was the speech after speech after speech, what was the content of that?
Well, my Republican colleagues who spoke did some nice tributes to those fallen victims of gun violence, starting with the Virginia Beach victims as well as others. And that certainly, you know, we applaud our sentiment of support for them. There are some Democrats, colleagues of mine, who spoke about the tragedies, including those that represent Virginia Beach. And the one in particular that was very, very heartwarming, moving, and just heartbreaking was my colleague Chris Hurst, his girlfriend, Allison Parker, was tragically shot and killed on live TV back in Roanoke. This is a couple of years ago. And Chris happened to be a TV anchor at the time. So he has seen gun violence in his own immediate very close network. So he gave a very impassioned about how we can't afford to not do anything on gun violence. unfortunately, none of those very heart-wrenching speeches made a difference because the speaker gaveled down the session, and we're done with the session after those speeches.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, Maria was growing up was somebody that knew how to use a gun, trained to use a gun. Mm-hmm. I was certainly growing up. I don't think either Maria or I want to take everybody's guns away, but we do want, you know, it just boggles my mind that we can't have sensible
common
gun.
Sensible. Yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, just to give you piggyback on what the senator just said, my dad was a sharpshooter and used to travel. Wow. He went to a military high school in Chicago. He used to take public transportation with his rifle back and forth back in the day. And he was an NRA member, and he taught us, me and my siblings, how to shoot when we could stand. Target practice, you know, never at anything alive. At beer cans, usually empty ones that we used to shoot at. I've never owned a gun, and my dad's collection stays with my mother since he's passed away. But I, again, like the senator said, I don't have a problem with people having the right to bear arms, but the assault weapons and the pumps and all of that stuff that is going on now has no place, I don't think, in our country.
Yeah,
that's right.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
No. I was going to say that I own firearms myself. I've shot many, many times, and I've grown up in situations where I have seen people defending themselves using firearms. And so I do believe in the Second Amendment. I think there's certainly a place for the Second Amendment to be part of our self-defense mechanism. So I don't have any problems with those law-abiding citizens who want to own a gun for either for sports or hunting or for self-defense. The question is, for those people who are not using the guns for those reasons, but in fact using it for offensive reasons, or those that have mental health issues or other delusional drives that end up forcing them into violence, and then we also know that for those domestic violence situations, the presence of a firearm makes it that much easier for that tragedy to end in lethal way. And having guns in the house also makes it that much easier for somebody to commit suicide, especially young people who are desperate. And so there's no question that firearms and the availability and easy access can lead to violence and tragedy. So what we're trying to do, we're not saying that we're going to take guns away from people. We're not saying that we're going to make it tougher for just average law-abiding citizens to buy guns. What we're saying is, for those that should not have guns, those that we know are a threat to other people and to themselves, we got to find different measures at the point of sale, at the time that they're purchasing, to go through background checks, and then to limit the amount of guns and ammunition they can purchase and the types of weapons that they can use. And these are not only common sense solutions, but these are solutions that overwhelming, we're talking about 85-90% of Americans agree are the right solution, and yet we won't even give a chance to have an up and down vote on these bills, and that's the shame of what happened in Virginia.
And that's what really gets me when it comes to not having the political will, politicians not having the political will to stand up. It really comes down to the NRA, doesn't it? That fear that money and pressure will be exerted by this important lobby. And, you know, people got to realize that the world has changed. You talked about your dad riding on the bus, Maria. Uh-huh. When I went to Spain with my sister at 16 years old, she took me to Toledo, where I bought a 3.5-foot sword, handmade sword, which I still have, which I brought on the airplane and put in the overhead compartment. I mean, imagine today. Yeah. But I brought it on the airplane. The stewardesses thought it was cute because I was a 16-year-old boy with a sword. You know, they're like, oh, how cute is that? Let's put it in the overhead bag. But the world has become a different place, and gun laws need to change too.
Yeah,
right?
And the only thing I would mention about you mentioned the NRA, the National Rifle Association. Interestingly, I actually represent the physical headquarters of the National Rifle Association. They're based in Fairfax, Virginia, and they're a part of my legislative district. So in a kind of an ironic twist, I'm the NRA's representative in the General Assembly.
That is ironic.
Isn't that funny?
But yes.
Yeah, I used to actually work across the street They used their headquarters used to be across the street from the DNC. When I worked for the Democratic National Committee, they were directly across the street on Thomas Circle, which is now a hotel, I think. But
I've talked to both the NRA's officials as well as a lot of their members, and I'll tell you, there's absolutely no this really bothers me. If you talk to the NRA members, I mean, your law-abiding citizens, my neighbors and constituents who joined the NRA to get a discount on using their firing range, or maybe they get a discount on some product that they buy, they couldn't care less about these policy issues. They think that, having more laws that protect bad people from getting guns is a good thing. They think that universal background check and safety issues and preventing kids from getting access to guns, they think those are all good policies. It's just that the NRA leadership, the paid staff, their lobbyists, their marketing people, the ones that are on TV, they're the ones making it really tough for other law-abiding gun owners to have a voice in this debate. So if you ask and poll the average American out there, I would say a vast majority of people, Republicans and Democrats, will all agree that these are the right solutions. But when you've got paid, special interest lobbyists who get paid specifically to stop bills from being passed, that's the problem. And I think that's the problem across the board with all of politics nowadays. It's just too many people, join the little group, and then they take a side, and they just don't feel like they can move out of that little box that they're in.
Yeah, I think that's very well put.
Well, the irony, though, is that the NRA started initially to help promote gun safety and the use of guns, appropriately. And then they got this, I don't know what you would call it, but it's when they established the part where they could lobby for
that's
gun.
Right.
Yeah,
yes.
That's where they kind of went off the beaten path.
Yeah.
Which I don't really, I don't know how that reconciles with them and others. Because initially they wanted everybody, whoever had a gun, to know how to use it and how to use it correctly and responsibly. And that was their whole point, is let's make sure that we have law-abiding citizens using guns. It wasn't about what they've become. They strayed from their origins.
Yeah, they got powerful, and power corrupts. And, the mafia started as a group of citizens who, band together in families because the Italian government was dysfunctional. And they started out basically as a civic organization. Of course, as they grew, I can tell you, as a kid that grew up in Newark, New Jersey, they weren't much of a civic organization when I was a kid. They weren't interested in civics. So that happens. But, yeah, I think this is just such a perplexing problem for us too, and especially in this region, because we had 600 illegal guns seized last year that were traced to Virginia, and we have very tough gun laws in Washington, but not in Virginia, not in Maryland. So it really is kind of a moot point for us. Because if you it's an easy trip across the river or across the Maryland state line if you want to buy a gun. So I think I wish we could come together regionally to make some positive decisions to take the guns out of hands of people that shouldn't have them. But let's move on. I know you've worked on a lot of other things. I know you have children in public schools, and you put forth some legislation, I understand, to improve public schools. Now, in D.C., this is a national disgrace. Our schools are listed 49th out of 51, some of the worst schools in the country. Yet, in Fairfax County, you have really good schools. In Montgomery County, you have good public schools. So what's the... What's going on with public education in Virginia these days?
You were breaking up just a little bit because I'm on a cell phone right now.
Sorry.
I might not have caught everything, but good news about our state is that we remain as one of the best states in the country for public education, not only from K through 12, but higher education as well. And in some ways, we are the envy of the country in terms of attracting the kinds of future jobs, regardless of which way you view the landing of Amazon's headquarters in Virginia. The reality is Amazon could have gone anywhere, but they chose Virginia. One of the main reasons is because of the talent pool that we would be able to attract that would go into the technology industries through Virginia Tech and other schools that we have. So we're very proud of that. Now, having said that, the part that we are lacking and we are falling behind is how we treat our teachers, the most important person in that classroom other than the children, who will be the teacher that teaches them. And we don't pay them as well as we should and at the level of professionals that they are. So teacher pay has always been one of the tough ones. We've given them a raise this year and last year's budget, but we can certainly do more. But we also want to be able to provide the kids with that innovative, creative ways to think so that they can be ready for the jobs of the future. So that's one of the areas that I focus a lot of my time is thinking about how do we reform education in a way where we're not just literally babysitting our kids for 6 hours or 7 hours a day, but to give them skills so that they can become really full-functioning adults and professionals into the future. And I think we're making some good progress there.
Well, as if Mrs. Brown didn't already like you enough, she's a Fairfax teacher. So,
oh, is that right?
yeah, she's the head librarian at Annandale High School. So, so she's all about paying teachers more, and so well, am I. So that's it.
I'll tell you a quick story about that. I had a bill about 3 or 4 years ago that I introduced. It was such a simple bill that you could write it on the back of a matchbox if people still use matchboxes. But it said something like, Virginia Commonwealth believes as a policy that libraries are essential services to the government. It was as simple as that. And so when I introduced the bill, my colleague said, what's this about? I said, I want to make a policy statement that says in Virginia we believe that libraries are essential services. And he says, what does that mean? I said, well, we don't want people to shut down libraries because they don't think it's important. We think it's really important for a lot of reasons. And so it passes the committee that was introduced to it. And then it got referred to the Appropriations Committee. I said, why would it go to Appropriations? That has nothing to do with money. And they said, well, if you put language in a statute that says something is essential government service, that means we have to fund it. That means we have to come up with money in the budget. I said, that's a good idea. Why don't we do that? And they said, well, we can't. So they killed the bill because they thought that it meant that we have to fund it. But I made the point really clearly that, look, if we are going to make libraries essential service, which I think we should, because without libraries, we don't have access to information. And for young kids, especially those that are underprivileged, who don't have books or internet at home, they need to go to the library to get the information. We got to treat it like the professional facility that it is. And so I wanted to make that point. So I believe I was the only legislator in the country that ever put legislation in that's declared that libraries are essential services.
I love how you got there logically. That's the attorney in you, isn't it? Right? Right? You make a point, and then you build on it and build on it, and then they can't disagree with you because they helped you get there.
And after that, look, and after that speech, I can see Mrs. Brown putting your picture up on the mantle. Because that's really, you know, she's had to fight in the District of Columbia. She ended up going to Annandale. She's an adjunct professor at Catholic University, but she teaches in Annandale because she left the D.C. public school system. She used to run all the D.C. public school libraries because they want to get rid of libraries.
Wow.
They want to get rid of libraries in the district because they think now we have the internet. We don't need libraries. And it's really a fight that she goes through all the time that libraries are important. And, you know, I constantly tell her the very first act of Congress was to establish the Library of Congress. That's the very first thing they did when they got together. And, you know, it just shows you how important schools are still judged. Colleges are still judged, ranked in part on the quality of their library system. Mm-hmm. So,
and the two libraries of Congress are named after two Virginians. You have a Jefferson Building and a Madison Building. So there you go.
Well, you guys, you really do. You really are the birthplace of democracy in Washington, D.C. And I don't know if this is just an urban myth or whether this is true. But if you visited Washington, if you're out there listening, you visited Washington, you'll see that the Jefferson Memorial is built kind of on this little island in the Potomac River. And the urban legend is that it went there because Virginians got tired of having all their great politicians have memorials in Washington, D.C., you know, the Washington Memorial, the Washington Monument, a lot of things for Madison. And so they said, no, we're going to, this time we want it in Virginia. So
but you know what, Michael, I want to address, and maybe Delegate Keem, you can talk about this, because I'm getting my PhD and I use the library exhaustively from my university. Now, granted, it is electronic, but sometimes I'll look for something and I go to Google Scholar and you click on it and it's, they say, you know, this is the fee to download this article. Well, I cut and paste the URL, I go into my university's library and boom, there it is for me, because that's part of my tuition to have access to that. So even if we are electronic, it doesn't mean that we still don't need libraries and brick and mortar too, because I read books like where you turn the page and you read a book. And then I put it in my library, my personal library. So to have children or anybody not understand the value of what a book is, that you can hold it in your hand and it's not electronic and it's not, you know, a Kindle or what have you. Again, I also think that's a reason to have the brick and mortars. And I don't know if you have an opinion about that, Delegate Keem.
Not only that, but I didn't know this myself until I did some research, but most people don't know this, but the libraries are considered to be a emergency shelter under the Department of Homeland Security's regulations. And so every community that has a library is fitted with all the emergency requirements, you know, the shelter in place, the two-way communications, the batteries, extra food and such, so that if there's any kind of a tragedy or emergency, the first place you should go, if you can, is to the library, where they're equipped with equipment that most houses and I mean, if you're lucky enough to be near, let's say, a fire home, fire department or something like that, but most people might not. So libraries do serve an essential function in our society that goes beyond just the books and the and the periodicals. It really is a physical book, brick-and-mortar place. I also use the libraries a lot for just conference rooms and meetings. I mean, I have a lot of meetings. I used to have a physical office, but I realized most of my meetings I was doing, you know, meeting people where they were. So hardly anybody was coming to my office, and my staff and I decided to work virtually. And so now when we have meetings, we use our local conference rooms in libraries. And it's the best way for me to just sit in a library for a couple hours, meet with constituents. And then while I'm there, I'm actually looking at recent books, and I get some you know, audiobooks nowadays as I'm driving a lot. But it's a great resource that I use all the time.
And when you were – sorry, Michael, but you, Delegate Keem, you went to Hastings. I'm from California, by the way, and my nephew just finished his second year there at Hastings. He's going to be graduating next year. Were you in the library physically?
Yeah, that's where I took my naps. that's where I spent a lot of time. In fact, it was on, I think it's 198 McAllister Street, if I remember the address.
Okay.
I spent many, many, many hours in that library. And my friends and I would always meet there, and then we'd take a little dinner break, but we'd always end up coming back there because my apartment was so small, and it was kind of, as you know, San Francisco is a pretty noisy city. It doesn't matter where you live. The whole city is pretty noisy at night. So the library is one of the few places that we can find quiet peace and just, you know, study with other people around you that are also studying, so it gives you that motivation.
And one thing you have in libraries that you don't have on the Internet is you have librarians. And they're such an incredible resource. I don't know about you guys, but I got through graduate. If I didn't have some good librarians helping me, I might have never made it through graduate school.
Oh, Michael, I'm sure it was a good adjunct, but not that.
I was always amazed that you could go in to do a paper on agriculture in South America, and that at Maryland, which was a really big school, they'd have a South American agricultural librarian, you know, somebody that was an expert, and that always amazed me. But let's talk about other things that you've done. What are you working on now, Delegate Keem? What are your pet pieces of legislation these days?
Well, I'm actually at a conference right now with some of my colleagues from the House and Senate talking about some clean energy and environmental protection type legislation that we're going to be working on for next year. It's one of my passions. We all know that the climate crisis is real. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say we all. I mean, most of us, except for a few people who are deniers, believe that the climate crisis is the essential issue that we all should be concerned about, and it could be literally an existential concern for all of us. And so that's something I've been really focused on. I think Virginia, unfortunately, is falling way behind other states in terms of investing in renewable energy and creating an infrastructure that allows for us to have a lot more solar available to consumers and small businesses and municipal local governments. So that's something I've been passionate about. I'm also working on a number of bills for next year. And now, obviously, next year for us in Virginia is a brand new session because we have an election this year. Unlike most states, our state legislators are elected in odd years. And so this is a year when we're going to have the entire House and Senate up for re-election, which means if we are lucky enough to pick up a couple more seats in the House for Democrats, the Democratic Party will be in the majority. And so I may be able to serve in the majority status for the first time. And if so, then we'll have a lot more of an ambitious progressive agenda that we'll be pushing, including, you know, and we talked about gun control issues, but on education, on health care, on making sure that we have affordable college tuition. But there's so many issues that we need to be working on, and we'll see what next year.
Well, since you were talking about it being a campaign year, and I know you campaigned for Obama, are you campaigning for any presidential candidates this time?
I actually have been. In fact, yesterday I went to another meeting of what we're calling some of my friends who support Pete Buttigieg. We're calling it, instead of a meetup, we're calling it Pete Ups. So I had the fortune of getting to know Mayor Pete when he was just elected to be mayor of South Bend, Indiana. And this was around 2012, I guess it was. So I met him at a conference, and we became fast friends. And so he and I are part of a network of state and local elected officials who are working on things that really help grow the economy in an innovative way, where local governments and state governments can, you know, come to common sense problem solving together. And so we call ourselves pro-growth progressives. So we're Democrats, we're progressives, but instead of getting bogged down with all the social issues, the wedge issues, we're focusing on ways to grow the economy and making sure that we have good jobs. And so that's how I got to know Pete really well. And we spent several years working on some of these ideas and sharing ideas from cities and counties and towns and state levels. And so when I saw him last year at an event, and he mentioned that he was thinking about running for president, I said, "Oh, that's really exciting. I'm happy you're doing that. Let me know how I can help you." And so late last year, when he was getting ready to set up his exploratory committee, we talked, and I said, "I'm going to join you, but I just need to get through my legislative session first." And so I had to wait till the springtime before I can go publicly and announce that I was supporting Pete for president. So I've been on his campaign, and I know that we have, 35 or 40 people running now? I have no idea.
It's incredible. Maria and I had one of the candidates, Marianne Williamson. I think this show you're on now, Shadow Politics, I think is the first show that she went on. She was on it before was on CNN and some of the other bigger things out there. I haven't seen this many candidates, and I've probably worked now on 8 or 10 presidential campaigns, and I worked on one back in the '80s, which they referred to as the Seven Dwarfs, because we had seven Democrats, Jesse Jackson and Paul Simon and there were 8 candidates and Walter Mondale, and these guys just beat themselves up on the way to the primary. And of course, as a Democrat, that's my big concern here, is our 20, 30, 40 candidates, however many we have these days, it's going to just, get us to a point where we don't have a viable candidate at the end of the day. What do you think about that?
I'm very very positive about where things are, and even though we do have an unusual number of people, I think we have some really good quality as well as quantity. Yeah. I've had the fortune of knowing about half of the field personally. I've had the chance to work with many of them, Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar, Julian Castro, I happen to be close friends, and also Kamala Harris is a former Hastings alum, so we have some mutual friends as well. So I'm very excited about a lot of the top-tier candidates. And so when I decided to support Pete, it wasn't because of anything against any of the other candidates. In fact, there's many that I'd be very, very happy to support if they do become our nominee. But I thought that, for my purposes this year, I wanted the one person that could really make a difference, getting to know him well and working for, is Pete. And I'll tell you, I started my first presidential campaign in 1988 working for Michael Dukakis as well. And I started out as a DNC intern, and then I was hired as a staff. So I worked at the convention, and I've been involved in every presidential campaign since then. This is the first time in my life that I'm supporting a candidate for president who's younger than me. And I thought about that for a while. And it's a reflection both on the fact that I'm getting old, but more importantly, the fact that politics is always about the future, and campaigns are always about what can be, not what has happened. And so for me, as great of a country that we have and all the wonderful things that we've had so far, there's a way that we can make it even better for the next generation growing up, and to give them that hope and sense that they can really have the world that they deserve, starting with climate crisis and having peace around the world and having the respect again in the rest of the world's eyes, and also create, you know, solving the main problems that we're facing without having to get into these partisan fights all the time. And I think Pete offers that sense of hope, that sense of real experiences, and that steady and just common sense approach that he has. And I just find that so refreshing. So even though he might be somewhat younger in age, he actually has more years of experience than the current president, and the more years of military than both of them combined, president and vice president combined. And so for a lot of reasons, I think Pete's the right guy, and he's the right leader for our country and our time today. So I'm really excited about supporting Pete.
Well, now you just got another fan in the Brown family, because my 21-year-old daughter announced to me the other night that it was time for old white guys to stop running things. That's what she said as she looked at me. She said, "You know what, Dad? There's just too many old white guys out there running things. We need some younger people."
I happen to agree with her, I might say.
Well, as an old white guy, and I took exception with that, but I think she certainly has a point. And I'm sure if we sat down and talked, since I was also an intern at the DNC and worked there for many years, worked on the Mondale campaign, have many friends there. I'm sure we have many mutual friends that we don't even know about. And in fact, I'll give you one better. I was an intern at the DNC, and when I showed up at the convention in 1980, I found out that my supervisor was an intern. And I remember being stunned and saying to the guy, "I'm an intern to an intern?" He said, "Yeah, that's right." And I can't even imagine what that makes you, you know. Intern, I thought there was nothing lower than an intern, but somehow I managed to succeed in finding an even lower position. Let me ask you one last question, because we're running out of time. Sure. You don't need to answer this if you don't want to, but I'd like to know, as someone who came to this country and has succeeded so remarkably well, what you think about this controversy of people chanting at Trump rallies to send back, you know.
Well, first of all, as somebody who looks different than a lot of other Americans and who came from another country, I have been called that many, many times myself. You know, people have told me, for whatever reason, sort of, you know, half jokingly, half serious, and maybe in anger, saying, you know, "Go back home, go back to your country, you know, go back to where you came from." So unfortunately, too many people have heard that refrain from too many strangers throughout our lives that it's not surprising and it's not shocking, but certainly is very saddening and disappointing. But I think if you peel back the onion on that issue and you think about what it really means, I think there's a fundamental flaw in the thinking of those who espouse that view. Because by saying, "Hey, you don't look like you belong here in America, you need to go back to where you came from, a country that wherever you're from," by definition, you're presupposing that America has to have a certain look. The idea is America is a white nation founded by white people, for white people. Therefore, if you're not white and you look like somebody that's not somebody who belongs here, then you cannot be from here. You must be from somewhere else. But if we go back and think about the idea, the white people were the ones that came here from somewhere else and took the land from somebody that was more brown in color. And so for the Native Americans, if they were to say, "Hey, go back to where you came from," that would be the most appropriate statement ever in the history of America. And so for the whites that took over somebody else's nation and then have dominated this nation since then, to turn around and say, "Yeah, we welcome all refugees and immigrants and laborers and slaves. We'll bring people from Africa, from Latin America, from Asia, from other parts of the world so that we can use you for work and labor and slavery. But then the moment we don't like you, we want to tell you to go back home," that presupposes this idea that America was founded to be a white nation. I reject that wholeheartedly, because the history of this nation is not that. That might be some of the facts that were evident, but this country was founded on the idea that It's about the idea of free freedom and democracy and individual liberty. And so anybody that who believes in that, who leaves a country because they're persecuted, should be welcome here. So the moment we stop thinking about this as a white nation, but as a nation of ideas, that word, go back to your country, go back to where you came from, should not exist in the same philosophy. So I urge my friends who have that thought that this country is for certain types of people to really read the history and to understand that this country would not be what it is today if it wasn't for all these people who came from all these other places and that created this country as it is. So I really hope that President Trump and all of those who follow him and think alike like him understand that he is not only wrong in terms of the facts in history, but it is a very painful way of him trying to readjust and rewrite history in a wrongful way. And for the rest of us who believe that this is our country as much as it's his, we need to stand up and fight back and speak up and make sure everybody knows that everybody has a place in America.
Again, very well put.
I was going to say, hear, hear. Bravo.
That was beautiful. It really was. And I've got to tell you that one of the things that I've done over the years is train Native Americans who want to run for public office through a group called Indians List. And you're exactly right. I am actually having lunch with a Blackfoot Indian on Thursday. So you're right. Sometimes they say y'all should go back to wherever you came from, you know. And that's very well said. And I want to personally see us get beyond the rancor of the one side saying go back and our side saying resist. I think that we need to answer questions like this just the way you answered that question. We need to come up with reasonable, I don't know exactly the way to put it, but not just hateful speech on both sides, but to really look at what's underneath it all and examine it and say, yes, we're all Americans and it's about who we are and not what we look like. So thank you for that. And thanks for coming on the show. We're running out of time.
One last question.
Yeah, please.
It's a passion of mine too. Delegate Keem, I noticed that you're a member of Rotary. And I was curious how you find the time to do that and what your experience has been with Rotary.
Well, the Rotary's mission of service above beyond self is something I believe in. The four-way truth test is also something that I try to adhere to every day. But I've been a member for about 10 or 11 years now, and I'm supposed to go to my Wednesday lunch meetings every week, although with my schedule I don't make it all the time. But I really enjoy the organization, and it's done so much great work, and I've met some amazing friends through that program. So one day if I'm in your area, maybe I'll come and visit and,
And you'll attend my Rotary?
I would love to do that, Maria. Yeah,
that would be great. The reason I bring it up is because the Service Above Self and then the Rotary International and all that they do throughout the world. I was privileged to go to India to dispense the polio vaccine before it was declared eradicated. So I've been able to do some amazing things on behalf of Rotary, who help heal our planet little by little.
Absolutely.
Delegate Mark Keem, thank you so much for being on the show. Tell people how they can reach out to you. Do you have a website? Or I know you're running for re-election. Give us your website.
Everything is under my name. It's MarkKeam. So my website, my Twitter, Facebook, social media is all Mark Keem. And my email is info@markkeam.com. And I would love to hear from folks. And I really encourage everybody to listen to Senator Brown's radio program. And great to meet you, Maria, and I look forward to listening to your programs for many, many years.
Thank you so much. And we'll hope to have you back soon. I think you've just replaced me as Mrs. Brown's favorite politician. So that's one vote you'll get for sure. But thanks again so much for being on. And, you know, we leave you with the song every week. So since it's a campaign year in honor of Delegate Keem, we're going to leave you with a song tonight by Peter Gabriel called I Have the Touch, which is about reaching out to people. Maria, say goodbye for us.
Yes, we want to thank you and wish you much success and luck in your career again, Delegate Keem. And we also always want to thank our listeners who make the time and take the time to make us a part of their landscape because we know you've got tons of choices out there, and we're honored and privileged that you continue to make us one of your choices. So thank you. And thank you, Michael, for another beautiful program.
Well, we'll see you next week.
Yes, we will. All right. Have a great week, everyone.
Give the people their right to vote.